And Lord knows I can shoot a gun. That's just the way I was raised. This land is your land. This land's mine. Home is where my heart is. And to you, I am tied.
We're here at Two River Theater, where the musical Songbird will be running from June 9th through July 1st. Music and lyrics done by Lauren Pritchard, known in many different areas, right? Not only known as a singer-songwriter and a performer, but also we'll talk about her experiences early on in her career. Fabulous. I saw you in Spring Awakening. Aww. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But country music was something new for you because you've kind of dipped into all kind of genres of music. So let's talk about, on the bill, it says here, a new musical, but Songbird was off-Broadway in 2015. And you and Michael Kimmel got together in 2012. How did that meeting develop, and take us to the early etchings of this musical, Songbird?
Sure. So Songbird came to be not totally on accident, but definitely the universe was conspiring in our favor. I had Michael was working on another musical of his called The Last Goodbye, which is an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet paired with the music of Jeff Buckley. It's a really beautiful piece. And at the time, they were getting ready to move the show out to the Old Globe Theater in San Diego and perform it there. And they were casting for it, and I certainly was not right for the role of Juliet, but I went in and auditioned for the role. And I went through a couple rounds of callbacks and whatnot, and totally knew I was not going to get the part, but I sing rock and roll. So I was like, I think that's probably why I'm here. But anyway, I wound up meeting, I knew who Michael was, but I had never really met him before, formally met him before that process. And a few weeks went by, and I got an email from casting that said, Michael Kimmel would like to get in touch with you. Would you mind if we pass your email along? I was like, of course not. I would love that. So he reached out and he said, I have this idea for a show, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to sit down and have a conversation about how we could work together on this piece. And it just kind of started from there. We went, we sat down, we had a beer, and just really started, not even in a formal way, just started a conversation that said, what would it look like? How would we work on this? What would that creative process be like? And so from there, we decided to just jump in and see where things were going to take us and where the ideas of the show would then take us, because it wasn't like somebody commissioned us to do it or something. We were just going to do it and see, you know, how it was going to happen naturally. And he started writing stuff on his end, and I started writing stuff on my end, and we began sending things back and forth. That was the early creation process. And it wasn't that we didn't know what we were doing, but it was a shot in the dark. We just kind of decided, let's try this thing. Let's see what happens. And the whole thing has been a snowball effect, if you will, of the universe certainly being on our side of wanting to see this show come together. And but country music was very new for me. I mean, I was born and raised in Tennessee, so country music was something I've known in my entire life and loved and listened to and appreciated and have a very deep understanding of. But as a writer, it's not something I've naturally done. So it was interesting to begin the process. There was something actually very cathartic about working on this piece and really being able to show my love and appreciation for the place I came from that really ultimately taught me everything I know about music and life and love and loss and all of those kinds of things that we also talk about in this show. So that was a very helpful part of the process as well, being able to see how much of my life and my upbringing in Tennessee could directly reflect in what we were talking about in this show, whether it was something I personally went through or something I watched people around me go through.
We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson.
People know your hometown through Johnny Cash.
Right.
I mean, the famous song Jackson.
Of course.
You know, that he sang with his wife so wonderfully. I'm a huge Johnny Cash fan, so yeah. Obviously that means a lot to me. But when it comes to you and Michael, he obviously knew that there's something inside of you that could write this, because you write very emotional, powerful songs. Whatever you try to do, whether it's Lolo, sure. as your career as a performer, or whether it's a songwriter. So he knew that about you then. And
yeah.
I guess that was the reason, right? He felt that even though you hadn't done country, you knew the feelings inside that he was looking for.
I believe so. I also think that even though country music was not my first and foremost as a songwriter, one of the things that we have talked about recently about the difference of country music compared to a lot of other genres of music, it's the specificity in the writing. It's so specific. Whether it's a Dolly Parton song, which leans towards the more emotional side as well, or something a bit more lighthearted, like Take a Ride on My Big Green Tractor. Like, it's still really specific. You know exactly what people are singing about, and a lot of my own writing is very specific because I write a lot about my own life, my own experiences, and I'm very transparent with my writing, and I think that was a big thing for Michael as well, that he knew that I understood the importance of the specific moments that we needed to capture with all of our characters and the telling of this story. And I had never written a musical before this. And one of the things that I found incredibly challenging, but also it has gone on to be very educational through the rest of my writing life now, is really understanding the difference of not trying to say the same thing twice as well, and really finding different ways and specific ways to talk about things without feeling like you hear the character say their literal feeling and then also sing their literal feeling.
Here's all the money I have left. I hope you're happy with yourself. I hope you're feeling real good. Hope you smile real big when you look in the mirror now. Here's all my dignity. I didn't give it up so easily. But you just kept on turning that knife a little further in. I tried so hard to convince myself that you were just a dream. But my broken heart and bank account were too damn real to me. I don't feel like staring at the wreckage anymore. No, I don't. Oh, I wanna take my broken wings and learn to try again. Feel the high again that I lost when I found you. I wanna take what I have left and learn to fly again.
One of the things that did make this easy, to what you are saying about the emotionalness of a lot of my songs, they are all very emotional. I feel things very deeply. I always have. That's just sort of my MO. If you're a person who knows me, I'm very intense. I'm very thorough. It's just how I'm wired. And my writing definitely reflects that. But I think some of that, at least for me, comes from the fact that I believe that's part of the human condition. We all feel the things we feel, and whether they're silly or not, they're justified. They're our feelings. Our feelings matter. They are what they are. And in our story here in Songbird, we are talking about 10 people who have their feelings, and you're watching them throughout this story, and you might be thinking as an audience member, well, that is ridiculous, or that is selfish, or that is effed up, or that is cruel. But their feelings are still their feelings. And that's everyday life for every single one of us as we go through this life. So then breaking that down in song, it is going to wind up being pretty emotional because we see these people interacting in a heightened emotional state for a laundry list of reasons. So trying to be able to capture the different levels of those emotions too was challenging, but in a really fun way, and really pushed me to do some internal research about, well, maybe I haven't been through exactly that, but how would that make me feel? How do I think that would make me feel? What can I put as a marker in my life to say, well, maybe this was a little bit like that, and how did I feel about that, and how would I want to sing about that? How would I want to tell that in a story of a song? And so that was very helpful as well.
Through your songs, because I've never met you before, Lauren Pritchard, but I get the sense that critics and people that talk about what you are or who you are or what you write, I don't think really matters that much to you, but you did have the New York Times approval in 2005. Did that mean something to you?
Oh, man. It left me speechless for a number of reasons. It's hard to say that what critics say or those kinds of things don't mean anything to you. You know, there's the old like adage of like, never read the reviews or whatever. I feel that as a creative person, we're always so critical of ourselves. Any person who does anything creative, artistic, no matter what it is, and no matter what side of the table you're on, or whether you're on the stage or behind the scenes or anything, whatever you're doing, whenever you create something that is of yourself, and even if it's not in the art world, tech world, whatever it is that you're creating, there is a part of you that goes into that, no matter how strong you want to be about the whole thing. And so it can be for the betterment of your own psychological state to not always interact with the critics that are going to be out there, because they're going to be out there and they're going to say whatever they feel, because like I just said, feelings are feelings. People feel the way they feel, whatever it is, better or worse. But when you have things validate you in a certain way, it can do a lot of helpful work internally after you've gone through a long process of creating. And I think of Songbird as like the first child I'll ever have. more so than my albums in some ways, because maybe because it's a quicker process, and also the life of that process is a different thing in the sense that when you make an album, no matter what happens to it, it exists forever and ever. It will never die, even if it's a quote unquote critical dismal failure, right? In the world of theater, I think it's so much more difficult because there are things that can happen to your show along the way that are a death sentence, you know? So if you have things that can intervene and mean that your show can keep living and you can be validated in certain ways so that the life expectancy of the thing that you've created means more than just a glimmer of a quick second, there's something about that is very helpful.
And it's interesting that you mention that, because the show that people recognize you first from, it was Spring Awakening, and that show had a revival in 2015. It's still relevant today, the message. Mm-hmm. That's a show that will never lose its significance, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But we're speaking with Lauren Pritchard. She wrote the music and lyrics for Songbird, the musical that's running at Two River Theater here from June 9th through July 1st. Can you give us a little synopsis about this music star who returns home and her relationship with her son and everything?
So Tammy Tripp in our story is a big, fancy star. And through the evolution of her career, she went from being a good old Nashville girl to eventually, I don't want to sound cliche, but, you know, succumbing to the industry and moving to Los Angeles and trying to modernize her country sound. And these kinds of things we read about, we use in our fictional story. And they are real things that happen to people every single day in this industry. And she returns home because her son has begun songwriting and he wants to present material for an evening. And she comes back to be supportive, but she's never really been around. And she has a relationship to these people because they were her original family and very close friends and her unit as she was growing up long before she became the famous star that she is. So there's that feeling of that she's indebted to these people permanently kind of vibe. But she hasn't really been around. So here we are thrust into this world where it is a coming together of a lot of things all in one evening. And the relationship with her son is very tumultuous. She was not a mom. She chose to have a child. But she chose her career over her child. And so there's high dysfunction and high heartbreak going on 24/7 in the world of Songbird.
I wanna take my broken wings and learn to try again. Feel the high again
that I lost when I found you.
I wanna take what I have left and learn to fly. Feel the high again.
Learn to fly again, again, again. Oh, again, again, again. Again, again, again.
Fundamentally, what happens in our story is we see these 10 people, but especially Tammy and her son, the character Dean, dealing with what happens when you don't deal with your problems and don't deal with your life. And then all of a sudden, one day, after years of trying to avoid things, you can't avoid it anymore. And you are confronted with all of the decisions you've made in your life up to that point, better or worse, and how you are going to reconcile certain things with yourself. And then also how there might be things that you may never be able to really apologize for because it will never be enough. And we watch all of these people navigate this. And in and amongst that, they are trying to find joy in any little moment that they can to help sustain them in a positive way through this moment, because they're trying to hold so closely to the past and memories of joy when things were simpler and less complicated and all of those kinds of words. So Tammy is, and because Tammy is in our story, this big fancy star, she has that thing about her where even if she's, no matter what she does, people make allowances for her, in that there's always going to be a yes person for her kind of way, in ways that they would never make the allowances for anyone else, including themselves. So that's also an interesting dynamic that we see throughout this story. But I do think, obviously I'm biased as all get out about it, and I don't care. But I do think that the thing I love the most about this story is it feels very real. Everybody has, I think, in my opinion, what I've learned in the living of the life that I've done so far is everybody has a person or people in their lives that they're never going to be able to lie to. They're never going to be able to escape. But in the good way, they're the real people in your life who keep you honest and keep you in check when you need it, either because you're going through something in your life that's maybe making you not know who you are right in those moments, or, you know, whatever it is that has carried you through your life to where you are, but there are always those people who will remain the people that will keep you the most true because they knew you first before the world affected you in any way, no matter what it is that you choose to do in your life. And some people never or try very hard to stay away from those people in their life because sometimes, because I feel a lot of people can be running away from the truths that they want to hide from. And we see in our story these people realizing they can't run away from their truths. Even if you try with all of your might to avoid it, somehow it always has a way of finding you. Like, the truth will always have a way to find you. And that the truth is the truth, but the truth is not always easy to hear. So we see a lot of that in our story.
Lauren Pritchard joins us here from Two River Theater. Her music and lyrics for Songbird that received critical acclaim and by the New York Times and many others when it made its off-Broadway debut in 2015, now here at Two River Theater. You mentioned the people that mean the most to you. Many of those still are in Tennessee with your family. What has been their reaction to Songbird?
They're very excited for me. First and foremost, I have an incredibly supportive family, and they've always been that way. I didn't necessarily come from a creative family in the sense that nobody in my family professionally ever went into the art industry, the performing art industry. My mother is one of eight, and several of her sisters are incredible artists, painters, sculptors, that sort of thing. But no one ever did this type of thing for a living, and I started creating when I was very young, and my parents, my grandparents, my cousins, my aunts, my uncle, everybody would just be sort of going, we're not really sure what she's doing, but we love her, and so we're just going to support her through all of this, and she has a desire for it and a heart for it. And so I was very grateful that I grew up with people who did not necessarily understand what motivated me to always be so creative, but did not even question it one moment and just said, we love you, we support you, we're going to do whatever we can to help you do whatever you want to do to make this desire that you have become a reality, which was an amazing support system to have. They're incredibly happy for me. I think also there are parts of members of my family who really love country music, so they were very excited that I was creating country music. It was something they would always say, why don't you write country music? And I'd be like, I don't know, I'm just not doing that right now. I'll get there, I'm sure. And so when I began working on this, they were very excited, which was thrilling. And yeah, I think the thing for me, especially because Songbird is set in Tennessee, that's where I was born and raised, and there's, I think just accidentally, there's a lot of truth to this story that I can reflect within my own life. Growing up there and living there, and even things with my own family that I can relate to with this story. And so I think that a thing that's been incredibly important for me is feeling like we're telling a story that feels true to what I know to be Tennessee, to what I know to be my life there, and there then when I grew up there, and there now, since I live there now again. So trying to be honest so that also we paint a correct picture of the South, because you know, the South is it's my favorite place. I mean, I love it, and I always have, and I've been very attached to it, and not just because of my family, but I love the state of Tennessee. It is a big part of my identity. But Tennessee, along with a lot of the Southeast, we got some issues, and there's work to do everywhere, but we have a lot of work to do down there, and we have for a long time, But the South is not only this very divided, specifically, I feel like racially, there are a lot of things that get said about the South. But I believe that those things that racially get said about the South are also true to be everywhere. I think the South just can't shake a lot of the past. And so there are a lot of things like that that are sort of related to the South and that I feel like I've wanted to make sure we keep very honest so that we're not painting a fictional picture of what Tennessee is like. Because it's a really beautiful, welcoming, kind, generous place that people live and are fruitful and happy in still to this day, and all kinds of people. And we're all just a whole bunch of people living together and trying to get along and trying to figure it out. And so trying to paint a very honest picture of that, painting a picture that feels very accurate, feels like an important thing to do, especially right now where I feel like we can be very divided in this country about a lot of different things.
If you want to get a sense of the feeling that Lauren Pritchett is about, all you have to do is watch the video. She performs as Lolo. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is watch the 2016 video Shine, and you'll see the inclusiveness. You'll see the power behind that song.
We're all strung out and lost, but can't speak of it. Wars you're fighting in your mind, they own you. Are you gonna get out if the drugs bail out? Who is gonna save you now? Take another drink, but you feel nothing, like you're the only one who don't need saving.
This play, this musical, based on Chekhov's The Seagull. Did you have any experiences with Chekhov before this?
So I didn't like go to college or any of those things. I started working when I was a friggin' child, and I was very lucky, and I didn't go to school. Maybe I should have. I still have nightmares about it, like, every other day. Actually, like, I'll wake up in a cold sweat, like, ah, I should have gotten a degree, because I'm a crazy person. But I didn't go to school to do this sort of thing. And I know that if I would have, most people, when they do that sort of thing, they spend a lot of time with this Chekhov play, specifically The Seagull. It was a revolutionary piece of theater for its time. It was a very different approach to telling a story. He was just talking honestly about people and their feelings, and he didn't really do that back then. And also there were, like, you know, some not so pretty topics in the show. And kind of honestly in a Spring Awakening type way too, where it was like, let's talk about the truth when you didn't do that, you know? And I had never performed the show, but I have seen the show performed a lot, and I have spent time reading the play before in the past, long before I ever worked on this. But then it had, until Michael and I started working on this piece, it had been a while since I had visited The Seagull. The last time I had seen it performed, I saw it when they did it in the park years ago when I first moved to New York, when I was doing Spring Awakening, and Meryl Streep was in it. I'm trying to think. It was like a big fancy A-list cast. It was crazy. It was amazing. It was beautiful. That was the last time I had, like, spent any time with the piece. So being able to revisit it when I was a bit older, and I was still, like, you know, a baby adult, but I was older, certainly, and I could have a better understanding of some of the things that were going on in the story and how I related to those things better and understood those things better. And The Seagull is a story that I think is timeless because of how it talks about all of the many issues that happen in the story. And the interaction feels very real because it is. It's these people reacting to their emotions, reacting in the moment, which is all that we all do anyways every single day. And Michael has done a beautiful job of keeping very true to the text of the play, but also making it feel very modern and relevant and understandable and translatable to how it completely applies to our lives right now, and also how things have not changed, how we're still dealing with all the same issues that we've always been dealing with all these years. Love, loss, desire, heartbreak, wanting, yearning. We have these 10 people who are yearning. They desire. And they each desire something different, really, actually, when you get down to brass tacks with each character. But they all have these desires that they want to see come out into the world.
there anything specific about this cast? Some members that were in the original are here. Anything about this specific cast that you want to talk about?
Sure. The thing I'd love to say is, so part of the reason why we don't have some of those people before us, it was scheduling conflicts and these types of things. We have an incredibly generous cast. This show is a huge ask. Our cast, they're not just doing the acting work and the singing work. They're also the band. There's no other band. They are it. So everything that you see, everything you hear, everything that goes on, they are 100% creating live in the moment the whole time you're watching the show. And it is a lot of work, and we understand how much work it is. And I am always completely bowled over and astonished and humbled and amazed and grateful at how generous these actors are. They give not 100% of themselves. They give 250-300% of themselves to this piece, to the music, to the intention, to the execution, to all of the areas of this piece. They pour themselves into it. And it really is very humbling to create something and then find a group of people who care about it as much as you do as the creator. And I'm never not amazed by that. It's always the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Because you just never really know what these processes are going to be like. And though I've done a lot of creating in my life, this being on the other side of the creative table for this show is such a new world for me that I'm still navigating, where I'll say, do you think we can do this? Or how do we do this? And they're like, oh, well, you can just do that now. You wrote it. And I'm like, really? Are you sure? I still have to remind you that it's a world that I'm still really learning. And I always wanted, when I grew up, to be a composer. And I never really knew when that was going to happen. And it was also something that I thought that I wasn't going to get to do until I had done a lot of other things and really, quite honestly, was going to be much older. So I think that there's been a big part of me that has also had to come to terms with the fact that this started happening when I was 27. I'm 30 now. But it started happening when I was 27, and I was kind of in a state of shock for a couple of years, going like, how did this happen? What's going on? Am I okay? Like pinching myself. Am I okay? Is this real? Am I here? Is this okay? Especially when you see the show performed by these incredible actors, these incredible spirits, pouring out this material, it leaves me speechless, kind of.
We're speaking with Lauren Pritchard, who wrote the music and lyrics for Songbird, playing from June 9th through July 1st here at Two River Theater in Red Bank. You mentioned that you didn't go to college, but for me, your schooling is your journey, is from Jackson, Tennessee, to L.A., to the U.K., back to the U.S., now eventually back to Tennessee. That's It's all about real life.
Yeah, I mean, my life has certainly been all about real life, or at least my version of real life. I mean, I do understand to a certain degree that my life is not normal, per se, in theory, in some ways. But for me, I've never been in a hurry to do anything. I'm in a hurry to get it right, but I'm not in a hurry to do it. Meaning, this life that I'm living will always be a creative one. And I'm happy for things to happen when it's time for them to happen, whatever that means. And I'll be doing this for my whole life. So you have to figure out how to make that sustainable as well. Because you can't just do it all right away in one thing. Not necessarily because you run out of things to do, but like in theory, you can put yourself in a position where you can be a bit compromised by the things you've done and the things you've already done. Because the biggest thing I've learned in my journey is that the desire to create does not go away and the desire to do things does not change. What does change is that the situations change. The more you do and the more that the evolution of your life goes on, the more people you meet, the more experiences you have, the more projects you're involved in, the list of desires is going to just alter according to those things. And I heard a really interesting interview with Garth Brooks a few years ago that has really stuck with me, where he was a guest on Wait, Don't Tell Me a couple years ago. And they were asking him, so what do you do now after you're the number one country star of all time and you've won all the Grammys and you've done all the things, and what do you do now? And he said, well, that was why I had to take time away. It's not that I didn't want to win more awards. He said, and also I know I'm going to sound like a bleep hole, you know, when I say this, but what do you do after you've done a certain amount of things? And then it's not even that you're bored, it's that you're overwhelmed. The things change and you say, well, what do I do now? What is my next goal? Where do I go from here? And you will need to have times in your life where you take time away to be able to do the things that you just want to do, whether they're really successful or not. And I think what has really stuck with me about listening to him tell that interview is, like, Garth Brooks is one of those people that has, like, achieved the unachievable. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no way that even in your wildest dreams you can dream that big to a certain extent, because you just don't know what the possibilities are until or unless they start to happen. And that's been a very interesting thing for me to navigate throughout my own life, is that, you know, when I was a little girl, I knew that I wanted to grow up and be creative and share my writing with the world. But it can be really hard to dream up what that means if you don't really know or you haven't really lived it. And so until or unless you do, or you start to, or you're lucky enough to even be able to do it, and which is how I feel. It's not like I haven't worked really hard to get here, but also I feel that I've been incredibly lucky to have the experiences I've had and have people take a chance on me and really listen to the things I've written and take a risk with me and for me. And I've really let the music guide me every step of the way. So when the music guided me away from Tennessee as a young girl, I moved away in junior year of high school, and I really let the music guide me there. Then the music guided me to New York for Spring Awakening. And then when that process was completed and I left the show was still running, but I left the show, music was really guiding me to the UK. There was a person there that I desperately wanted to write and record with. I got lucky enough to get into a room with him, and then that turned into a thing in and of itself. And then the music guided me back to America. And then the music guided me back to Tennessee. It's been an interesting process because I've tried to think hard enough about what I'm doing so I get the work done, but not think too hard about it so that I'm too much in control. Because I feel that the art has to be a living organism in and of itself, because it is a big guiding light.
The late Carl Castle, who passed away earlier this year, would be thrilled to know that Wait, Don't Tell Me, that you reference that show, the NPR show. Of course, we're an NPR affiliate, WBGO. Let's go back to the Eugene O'Neill Theater.
Mort Stiefel?
Ilsa, you frightened me.
What are you looking for?
If only I knew.
Then what's the use of looking? I'm on the way home. Want to come?
I don't know.
God. You remember how we used to run back to my house and play pirates? Venla Bergman, Melchior Gabor, you and I?
Spring and summer, every other day. Blue wind gets so sad, blowing through the thick corn, through the bale of hay, through the open books on the grass. Spring and summer. Sure, when it's autumn, wind always wants to up and haunt you. Whistling has got you. With its heartache, with its sorrow, winter wind sings and it cries. Spring and summer, every other day. Blue wind gets so pained, blowing through the thick corn, through the bales of hay, through the sudden drift of the rain.
Question I'd like to ask you about Spring Awakening. You are a creator. You created the role of Elsa in Spring Awakening back in 2006, making its Broadway debut 2005-2006, right in there. Take us to opening night and take us to your last performance.
Sure.
What was the difference between your character and those from those two nights?
Oh, I feel like there was so much difference and also not at all. The three nights for me, the three performance nights that really stand out in my mind that I will truly never forget are opening night, my last performance, and the day after the Tony Awards. Obviously, you know, there are so many other memories that I have from many, many, many performances, but opening night was one of those nights where also specifically for me, I was sick as a dog. I was so, you know how these things go where you're all in a room, we're all in the same building together, and then all of a sudden one person has the flu, and then the next thing you know, the entire building has the flu, and it's like it doesn't matter how many times you wash your hands or try to, like, everybody stay away from each other. It's like these things happen. They happen in offices. They happen in, you know, whatever, all the time. So I was the lucky bird who got the last bout of the flu after it had completely gone all the way around to every single cast member. And it just so happened that there it was on opening night. So I was also, I was like on a whole bunch of, you know, like drugs from the doctor just so that I basically didn't like barf all over the stage, which was interesting in and of itself. And so I was deathly ill, but also I was on such an endorphin high because I was so excited that I was like the happiest I've ever been. You know what I mean? It was an interesting night for those reasons. And I remember feeling on opening night that was Jonathan Groff actually, and we talk about this not a lot, but he always brings it up because he said, you were so sincere when you said it. He said, and I think that you meant it and you had an understanding of what was starting to happen. And what I said to him, so we walked out on stage every single night. There were two curtains, one on the right side, one on the left side, that the cast would walk in and out of in the very backstage on the wall. Our set was a bigger life-size model of the Atlantic Theater. So the curtains resembled, you know, what we in the Atlantic Theater would have been walking through on and off. It was the only way on and off stage. So they kept that as the thing. So, and there was a red light in each corner that when the red light went off, it meant we would walk through the curtains and walk out, and then the show would start after we sat down in our chairs. And I was the first one out. Jonathan was directly behind me. So out we would walk, but we were standing back there, and we had gotten back there early because we were so excited. And he was like, I'll meet you back there a few minutes early. Great. So we're back there. And we did our sort of like, we had like a evening routine where we would like crack two recurring jokes and laugh and giggle. And then I looked at him and I said, Jonathan, I think this is the first day of the rest of our lives. And he thinks about, we talk about that sometimes because he was like, I don't even know what prompted you to say that. But I think that you just could understand the excitement and you were willing to go on the journey, no matter what it was, for better or worse. And I remember feeling that at opening night, I remember feeling that it was the first time I ever really felt like I knew Ilsa. I finally knew her. I finally knew her, not just in my brain, remembering everything I needed to do, but really fully in my body, I really knew her. Finally, after like 6 months of well, more, like 9 months of working on her, because we had done the show previously off-Broadway a few months before that. And so getting to opening night, I mean, getting to closing night from opening night, I felt like by the time I got to closing night, I was her. And it was this very strange feeling of saying goodbye to a person that you know that you'll never be again. It makes me feel very emotional to think about, because I'll always be her. And there's a part of her, the spirit of the character of Ilsa, that I identify with so heavily, and I always have. So there's a part of her that I think will always live very deep inside of me. But it was also weird. It was weird saying goodbye to her. And I felt, but I think that's why also I felt like I had been through so much and she was so different on the last night. But also I felt like I was seeing her again for the very last time, like I had never seen her on closing night. And yeah, it was a very bittersweet process, because we were allowed to really pour a lot of ourselves into the creation of those roles. So it was a weird thing saying goodbye to.
I don't scream, though I know it's wrong. I just play along. I lie there and breathe. Lie there and breathe. I want to be strong. I want the world to find out that you're dreaming.
You were amazing. I mean, I got to see you, and as I watched that show, I knew that show, obviously. Not that I'm some sort of critic, but sure. You could tell that it was going to be a huge hit, and it went on to win 8 Tony Awards, and Jonathan was amazing as well. Mm-hmm. But it really, I think, changed a lot of things about theater, and I believe it really brought a lot of younger people back to Broadway, mm-hmm. that show connecting. You agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting to think about Spring Awakening and what happened with the show in 2006, because also I think about what on earth the experience would be like if it would have happened now with all of the social media and all of the stuff like that that just did not – I mean, Twitter didn't even exist except in semi-beta form in 2006. People were still MySpacing. Facebook was still for only college students. We lived in just a different world than we do now, and especially in the way that people interact with each other because of social media, and the way that people interact with the things that they love in the art world because of social media. And watching the way that people our own age, I mean, we were all the basically the ages we were playing or very close to it. And it was really amazing watching people our own age come and feel as connected to the story we were telling as we were telling the story. And there was something very encouraging about that, to know that we felt, because we all, as we were doing the show and performing it every night and sharing it with the world and telling this story, we all really felt in our hearts that we were telling something that we really knew and understood and felt that we were living and being very honest about. And so not just to have people who were older than us validate that for us, but have people our own age say, yeah, that's actually right. That is how we feel. And this is what we're going through. And we do feel that this is what the relatable truth is. It was an amazing feeling. And also it could be heavy at times. I know that I speak for all of us in the cast when I say we would receive letters. I don't really want to call them fan mail, because they were very personal. We would receive very personal, beautiful letters from people of all ages, but we would also receive very beautiful letters, very personal letters all the time from people who would write to us and say, also sometimes things that were very personal, like, I've never told anyone, but I've actually been sexually assaulted. And now I feel brave enough to maybe reach out and tell someone because I've seen this story. And there was something really remarkable and also kind of devastating about that side of it, but also left at least me feeling very hopeful that Spring Awakening made me strong enough to do a lot of things in my life that I never thought I was going to be able to do, still to this day. And so knowing that we were hopefully able to do that for a lot of other people, especially young people too, and there was something incredibly hopeful about that, knowing that the story was helping people move mountains in their own lives.
We're speaking with Lauren Pritchard, who did create the role of Elsa in Spring Awakening. She's also the singer, songwriter Lolo. She's also done the music and lyrics for Songbird, the musical that opened off-Broadway in 2015, now running at the Two River Theater from June 9th to July 1st. You know, he just reminded me of with your talk about what this show meant to you. You remind me of Anthony Rapp, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing. Mm-hmm. And I believe that through his experiences in Rent, I think he's probably gone through the same kind of process as you that gave him the strength to do many things mm-hmm. and to talk about things mm-hmm. that maybe he wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And I liken the show, too, of experiences at that time when Rent was coming out mm-hmm. to Spring Awakening, the power that it had for those that age group and that awareness of culture that was going on. Did you ever think about the connection between the two?
Absolutely. I've known Anthony for years, and he and I are not close, but I've known him well for a long time because of just these are theater things that happen. I honestly will never forget, and they came a few times. Adina and Tay came and saw us a whole bunch of times. Anthony came. Adam Pascal came. Pretty much everyone except for Daphne, like from the original Rent cast, came and saw us. And every single time they'd come, and sometimes they'd all come together, and sometimes they'd be individually. And a few of them came a few times. And I will never forget them imparting their wisdom on us, which was incredibly helpful because even though, you know, in some ways the stories of Rent and Spring Awakening are not necessarily similar per se, they're also totally similar in the sense that they're very topical and they're approaching these subjects that normally people will tiptoe around. They're not doing that. They're doing it head on, whether you like it or not. The truth isn't always pretty. And I think that's a thing that both Rent and Spring Awakening really work very hard to comment on, to say the truth is not always pretty, but if you do not talk about the ugly truths as well as the pretty truths, you're going to be really disappointed and hurt and probably worse for it, because life is not always easy, life is not always beautiful, and you have to learn how to deal with it all. And sure, there are some people who are going to criticize the tellings of both of those stories. And you can't worry about those things because you can't please everyone. And also, I mean, I'll never forget sometimes having conversations with people who honestly didn't like the show because it made them feel too many things. But that's not our problem. That wasn't our problem. You know, our problem was to tell a story and make you feel something. And so if we made you feel too many things, like, you can't really be sorry about that. That's just kind of what can happen when you're telling a story that feels very true to life. But having them come and talk to us about parts of their journey and how they navigated going through stuff very similar to what we went through. It was kind of like a 0 to 60 experience where, like, 1 minute you're kind of like telling your friends and loved ones, like, yeah, hey, I'm going to go work on this thing. And then the next thing you know, like, the musical you're in is like on the cover of the New York Times and your face is in Times Square and everybody around you is going, wait, what's going on? You know, it's a it's an experience that can be very hard to explain what it's like to go through.
So I saw a funny clip of you doing some research. It was when you performed at 54 Below, and you said we hadn't really got together. It was a reunion there. We sang these songs. We know these songs. Mm-hmm. Which one is, of all the songs that you sang in the show, is your favorite and why?
My favorite song that I sang, that I got to sing in the show, was not even like my actual solo song. You know, there was a lot of singing on that musical, a lot of like everybody singing behind the scenes things. I think that my favorite song that we got to sing was the song My Junk, because I felt that that song specifically really summed up the kind of underlying message of the show. We've all got our junk, and my junk is you. Like, you're affected by everything that's around you and everyone that you interact with, whether it's for 1 minute or for your whole life. Things affect you no matter what you go through. And so I always, that song always made me feel incredibly connected to the show. But the song in the show that made me feel, I think, the most feelings of really capturing the heart of the story was the song All That's Known, or then in the second act, Those You've Known, that Melchior sings it first in the classroom in the first act and then in the graveyard in the second act.
Those you've known and lost still walk behind you. All alone, they linger till they find you. Without them, the world grows dark around you, and nothing is the same until you know that they have found you.
It's funny, actually, to be able to say these things out loud, because for a very long time when I would talk about the show, we could not talk about what happened in the show because it meant you were giving away the story. But now, 12 years later, I can say whatever I want to say about it because there are no secrets anymore, because you can pick up a book and read it. But so he says the line, I'm calling and one day all will know. And I think this feeling of that, this sense of discovery that we all feel, and that you must teach your children. You must teach, we must impart on the youth the importance of self-care, the importance of care for others, the importance of being honest, the importance of transparency, the importance of how to be helpful and not hurtful, the importance of giving a young person all of the tools they need to survive in the world, and really, really understanding what that means. That song, the all that's known song, I feel that always spoke about the importance of those things and how they are true in the story of Spring Awakening, and they are true in the living of the life for each and every one of us. That it is so important to give the young people of the world the tools they need to go be humans once they're on their own, once they're adults, once they have to take on the world just themselves. And yeah, I love that song. That song, all of the songs still mean so much to me, but I feel like that song still rings true year after year after year, especially as we navigate really trying times where there's a lot of transparency and people are seeing and hearing and talking about things that make people feel very strongly and have strong reactions, and whether it's politically or socially or whatever it is that we're dealing with. And I feel that the more we know, the better off we are, and that hiding from those things is only going to hurt us in the end.
The fact that you've been writing since you were young, I'll ask this question. Without Ilse, Is there a songbird?
Yeah, probably. But I think it would be very different. It's hard to say what it would be without that. I think there's... I also think it would be foolish of me to say, yeah, and not acknowledge that there's this tremendous part of my life that has then gone on to influence a lot of what I've done. Because how can it not? It was a life-altering thing. So I sort of, there's sort of like my life before Ilsa and then everything else after.
And speaking of everything else after, I'm going to be a little selfish here. The one thing that I will miss when I come to see Songbird will be the voice of Lolo, because I happen to really enjoy your voice. So when you're writing, it's, sure, you know, you're thinking about how you would perform it. Do you miss the fact that you don't get a chance to sing any of this?
No, I don't feel that way at all. I've never felt that way. I think partially because, like, I wrote it and they're mine, and so in theory I could sing them anytime I wanted.
Will you at some point?
Probably. I mean, we're working on an album for this, and the album that I'm wanting to create for this right now is not necessarily just a straight up cast recording. Eventually we will also do that too, but I think I'd also just like to present the music in a country music type way. So I definitely want that to exist. Interestingly enough, one of the songs on the record I put out with Atlantic in 2016, a song called Johnson City, is from this from Songbird, actually, although I don't think it's in the show anymore, but it was written for Songbird, I should say, originally, before it wound up on my album.
Calling, she wanna take my hand, and I'm all right. I'm all right. Maybe I did fall, but I'm not afraid to tell you more and more that I'm all right. Hey, child, look at you in the mirror. Did you think that you?
So I definitely don't feel that there's like a hard line in the sand about like what creatively I can put out in the world as myself and what only gets to stay in Songbird world. But yeah, no, I don't know. It's funny. I get so much joy in hearing people sing the music I've written. And even though I myself am a singer, and so I've created the demos for people to learn from, and then we teach the cast, and they're singing, and they're creating, and sure, it's like, yes, I've certainly written these songs a specific way, but also the songs in this show are supposed to feel like they came from these people, and it's supposed to feel like it belongs to them. So I've spent a lot of time making sure that these songs feel organically true to how those people sing as well. Because I do realize I have a very specific kind of voice and a specific way to sing that's good for me.
Your answer reminds me of Mike Reed, who had his country musical performed right here at Two River Theater, how we talked about. He was also, you know, a country music singer, and that, but he enjoys, too, listening to others do his music, give him special joy. When it comes to performing as Lolo, you got that nickname when you were a little kid. Who was the first person to call you Lolo?
One of my best friends, Alex. He started calling me Lolo Pritch because he was like, your name is too long.
How was he? How old was he back then?
We were 14, 15. We were young. And for a long time before that, people would just call me Pritch. It's kind of like the nickname for... It was like my dad's nickname in high school. It was my older brother's nickname in high school. It was just like an easy abbreviation. But yeah, Lolo evolved to Lo. And so people who are close to me call me Lolo or Lo, some version of that, some iteration. And you know, I Lauren Pritchard does wears many hats, and the music I make as Lolo doesn't sound like the music I've worked on it as an actor in musical theater per se. And it doesn't sound like the other music I work on with any of the other musicals I'm writing. And so to try to have it all be under one name was honestly very confusing for me. A lot of people are like, did somebody make you change your name? And I'm like, no. I needed it for my own brain to say, this is what this is. This is Lolo. This is Songbird. This is Lauren Pritchard. This is not that I'm like multiple personalities or something, but it's very helpful for my own creative brain to have things be that way. I think it's probably my obsessive compulsiveness.
I think you've said that Joni Mitchell, Al Green, two of the influences for you.
Big time.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Al Green is an enormous influence. Joni Mitchell is an enormous influence. Billy Joel is also another enormous influence. There's a lot of passion in all of their storytelling, and there's a lot of honesty in their songwriting, and there's a soulfulness, a very specific soulfulness to all three of those creative artists that I just really understood and attached to from the time I was very young. I started listening to all three of those artists. There was always a lot of music being played in the house growing up. My parents love music so very much. So there was a lot of it going around. My dad's favorites were Al Green and Steely Dan. My mom's favorites were Janet Jackson and Prince. So, and then also I grew up near Nashville, so I grew up smack in between Memphis and Nashville, so there was the blues always going on and country music always going on, and they kind of foundationally are the very same thing, just with different instruments playing it. So, like, the blues is basically, you know, as heartbroken as country music, just, like, without a banjo. So there was a lot of soul going on very early on that I was listening to, a whole lot of soul. And, you know, but somebody like Joni Mitchell, too, for me, like as a woman, was very revolutionary to listen to young, because I felt that she had, you know, she was like a big risk taker, and she would put lyrics in songs that like girls weren't singing then, you know, and taking liberties to say certain things as a female that now we don't really have to think about. But back then was a really big deal. And the way that she would write about her own life metaphorically, I felt that it was just incredibly beautiful. And songs like Both Sides Now, and, you know, I've looked at life from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's life's illusions. I recall, I really don't know life at all. I really don't know if songwriting gets better than that. I just don't know. Because it's so honest, but it's also heartbreakingly written in a way that is such a beautiful metaphor that you just so clearly know exactly what she's trying to say. And so I've always tried to put that into my own writing, of writing about things that people really know, you know.
So let's say the wonderful world of sound goes away for everyone tomorrow. Tonight you get to sing one more song just to yourself in the car. What are you singing?
Oh, that is a really interesting question. Such a hard question. I don't know. Maybe either. It's three things. I'm going to say three things because I don't think I'll be able to pick one. It would either be Don't Let It Bring You Down by Neil Young, Summer Highland Falls by Billy Joel, or I Say a Little Prayer by Aretha Franklin.
Summer Highland Falls is one of my favorites, so I was like, wow, that's really exciting.
I don't know. I'm not really sure why, but I used to not even really be able to listen to that song even when I was a little girl, because it made me cry, because it just – there was so much about that song that I'm not even really sure how, like, me as, like, a 10-year-old girl could even relate to that song, because it's, like, really not written for a 10-year-old. But I don't know. There was so much truth in that song that I just was like – And everything about it, it's really beautiful. Because also there's something about, like, even how the song starts. They say that these are not the best of times, but they're the only times I've ever known. That sentiment. There is magic in music, and there's magic in songs where you can write about something that, unfortunately, especially for something like that, which is actually like a really sad thing to say. These are not the best of times, but they're the only times I've ever known. That's kind of always the truth. There's always something going on. And I feel like, especially with the way that technology works in our lives now, it feels like every 5 minutes our phone is blowing up, telling us that the world is still ending. And as I've gotten older, that song just hits me in a deep, deep part of my heart that I know is because he's just writing about the truth in a way that will always be relevant.
And I believe there is a time for education in cathedrals of our own. Yeah. And your cathedral right now is Two River Theater, as you have for Songbird. As people leave Two River Theater here in Red Bank and have seen Songbird, what's the conversation you want them to be having as they leave the theater?
Well, of course, because Songbird is my child and I want people to be nice to my child, I hope that people are leaving ultimately with a feeling of satisfaction of some regard, that they're happy that they came to see us, they're happy that they bought the tickets and spent a couple of hours with us. But I also hope that people leave feeling that we told something that was real. It feels very real to us. We feel like we're telling stories about 10 people that people know. And I hope that people leave feeling like they met 10 people that feel familiar to them. Because that's, I think, what we hope we're doing here. You know, it's interesting when you're trying to tell stories. I feel like a lot of my life, I've not wanted to try to reinvent the wheel. I've just wanted to help keep the wheel turning, if that makes any sense. And so I hope that with this story, it feels like something people can really relate to.
For a change, I wish this was a video interview, because just watching Lauren's face throughout this interview, you got intensity, you got realness, you got sincerity, and you also got a beautiful smile. Aww. So she has all the emotions in there, and those emotions come out in Songbird, the musical at Two River Theater. What a pleasure it's been to sit down with you and talk about your wonderful career, both as a songwriter, but more importantly right now, Songbird the musical.
Songbird! Yes, I'm thrilled, and thank you so much for giving me the time and the opportunity to share my story and share the story about Songbird. I love this show with all of my heart. I've written and worked on this piece with all of the passion and the caringness that I have, and I'm so grateful to this theater and to the Two River Theater Company for giving us an amazing space to be able to share this story and present it to the world.